This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scherr. Do you have an imaginary friend, or did you, and now they are gone, tucked away, rejected, and lurking around, or dismissed? Two Northwest researchers have been looking at those imaginary friends and what they tell us about our secret selves. We find out this hour on Weekday. Stephanie Carlos is an assistant professor at the University of Washington in psychology. She was the lead researcher on the study that was published in the Developmental Psychology magazine, Journal. On the phone with us is Marjorie Taylor, professor and head of psychology at the University of Oregon. She's the author of Imaginary Companions and the Children Who Create Them. She joins us on the phone. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for asking.
Stephanie Carlson, what prompted you to take up this issue in the first place?
Actually, Dr. Marjorie Taylor is the pioneering researcher in the area of children's imaginary companions. And I was her student at the University of Oregon, and together over the years we've been following a sample of children, looking at their descriptions of their imaginary companions and how long they hang around and whether they still exist in school-age children.
Was it all very dispassionate like that? Was there any connection to your own life?
I've always been interested in pretend play, and perhaps that also derived somewhat from my own childhood interest in fantasy play.
But you didn't necessarily have an imaginary friend when you were young?
I would say that I engaged in a lot of role play, and my dolls were very real to me, to the point where driving across Death Valley with my family in a motorhome where the air conditioning had broken down, I was very scared that my doll was melting and literally dying.
Marjorie Taylor, what about yourself? I mean, I know that you've been looking at this, you've written a book about it, you've studied it. Did it stem from anything personal, or was it simply something you were curious about?
Well, my daughter had an imaginary friend, and that I was very curious about that, and at first I didn't even know that her imaginary friend was imaginary. I thought it was someone at her preschool. So that intrigued me, and then I started studying the fantasy-reality distinction. So I wanted to find out if children thought their imaginary friends were real.
Now, I noticed that in one of the articles that I read, somebody, either you were doing the interview, Professor Carlson, or you were doing it, Professor Taylor, and one of the younger people at the end of the interview pulled you aside and said, you know, this is just a fantasy, right?
Right.
Did it happen to you?
Yes, it did. In conducting these interviews, occasionally, I think children are surprised somewhat to have such adult interest and attention toward their imaginary friends, and perhaps are not used to having so many probing questions about it. And I think after a while they begin to question whether we have a grip on reality.
So what are you thinking about when you're talking to these kids and you find out that they have imaginary friends and they can describe those friends to you? What are the concerns you have when you start looking at them? Because I know Piaget had thought that this sort of imaginary fantasy and role-playing was a good thing. Was there ever a time when psychologists thought, oh, this is bad, this is dangerous? Professor Taylor?
Well, yes. In the past, some time ago, the original research on imaginary friends tended to be conducted by therapists who were working with children, and they'd find that children had imaginary friends, and they would wonder if that was part of the problem, and it got associated with having problems. But then Dorothy and Jerome Singer started to show that this was normative, that many children had imaginary friends. And then Stephanie and I were interested in it is a normative part of development, and so we wanted to see what are the characteristics of children who have imaginary friends, and we found them to be positive characteristics rather than negative ones.
Describe some of the imaginary friends that you met, or Stephanie Carlson met, or had them described to you.
Some of the more memorable ones had odd names. So, for example, Station Feta was an invisible imaginary companion created by a preschool boy, and Station Feta's job was to hunt dinosaurs at the beach.
Any for you that are memorable,
well,
Professor Taylor?
The thing, the thing that's surprising to me and continues to surprise me is that the diversity in the descriptions is just, it kind of blows your mind. The imaginary friends can be tiny, they can be huge, they can be babies, they can be a thousand years old, they can be boys and girls or Martians or ghosts or, any kind of animal, panthers, lions, squirrels. Even an invisible flea was an imaginary friend in one study we did. So it really is surprising, the diversity. We've had Nutsy and Nutsy were two that were really fun. They were invisible birds, very brightly colored and a little too loud for the child's taste. They tended to just talk too much. Fake Rachel is an imaginary version of real Rachel, who was in a preschool. The child liked to play with real Rachel at preschool, so she'd come home and play with fake Rachel. The diversity is really what is quite impressive.
We're talking about imaginary friends and what they say about ourselves with Professor Marjorie Taylor and Professor Stephanie Carlson. They're researchers in this, a new article on this, for which Professor Carlson was lead researcher and helping Professor Taylor and Eugene, came out in the Journal of Developmental Psychology. There's a TV show on by Craig McCracken, who created the Powerpuff Girls, Foster's Home for Imaginary Friends. It's a cartoon on the Cartoon Network. And it's for all those imaginary friends that no longer are being used, and they get sent off to this home, which raises the question of what happens to these imaginary friends. Why do they go away, I guess, Stephanie Carlson? Is it just because somebody gets older and says, oh, I don't need it anymore, I don't need this person helping me? What happens?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also considerable diversity in how the imaginary companions go away. In some cases, children report that they became bored and that it just got boring to think about it. In other cases, the imaginary friend meets with some kind of a demise, and the child will invent a story about how the imaginary companion perhaps got run over. That was kind of
interesting. I was kind of surprised by that. These imaginary friends, some of them are dealt with in pretty harsh ways.
Sometimes, and sometimes they're more of a nuisance in the way that children describe them than a friend.
Yeah, why is that? Psychologically, why do you have why do you create a fantasy that's a nuisance?
Well, I think children think about what it means to be a nuisance. I think they think about, what happens when you get sick, what happens when you get hurt, what happens when people are mean, and that's part of the pretend play. It's part of sort of mulling over these kinds of issues.
And what do you tell parents when you talk about imaginary friends?
Well, first of all, we tell them to relax, because some parents are concerned about what it means and wonder if this means there's something missing in their child's life, if maybe their child's having trouble making real friends. So we tell them to relax and also to enjoy it, that it's actually quite a nice tool for parents, because they can ask about what's happening with the imaginary friend, and sometimes children will say things that they might not say if they're asked directly. So they might be afraid of that dog who's moved in next door, and they don't really want to say, but they'll say their imaginary friend is afraid of it, and then hear what the parent has to say about that. So it can be a useful tool for parents to see, what is the child, what's on the child's mind right now.
There was, in doing some research on this, I came across a researcher who's looking at one aspect of imagination and play in England. And he was quoted as saying that the research raises the question at what stage parents should be concerned about a child who hears voices. And this professor, Fernie Haugh, who said hello to both of you, by the way, so the research varied but suggested that anywhere between 30 to 65% of children had an imaginary friend at some stage. They usually disappear. Parents should be reassured that all evidence suggests imaginary friends in childhood are normal. In fact, some adults, this was the article and the question I had, some adults who hear voices are now beginning to reject the stigma that comes with their symptoms. He said, there's a movement against the idea that just because you hear voices, you're mentally ill. For the last decade, there have been lots of people who hear voices and resist the idea that there's anything wrong with them. Now, in that description, though, it seems like there's a line being crossed. And I wonder what your reaction to that is, Marjorie Taylor, and how you're looking at it. Because I know one of the things you're looking at is how long some people do keep in touch with their imaginary friends.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see what kinds of activities in later life are similar in some respects to having an imaginary friend as a child. A lot of people have relationships with imaginary others in a playful way, and this does continue over time. So if we look at adolescence, there's research going on in Germany which shows a lot of adolescents will write to a diary and address it to an imaginary friend. And that, in some ways, is an activity that's like interacting with an imaginary friend early on in childhood.
You're listening to Weekday. We're talking about imaginary friends with Marjorie Taylor, lead author of a new study in the Journal of Developmental Psychology, and Stephanie Carlson, who was second author of the research on imaginary friends. Marjorie Taylor is a professor at the University of Oregon and also author of Imaginary Companions and the Children Who Create Them. Stephanie Carlson, a professor at the University of Washington, associate professor and assistant professor in the University of Washington in the psychology department. Let me bring in some of our listeners who, since I asked you all who your imaginary friends were and how you dealt with them. Marcia's in West Seattle. Hello, Marcia.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. I wanted to tell you about my imaginary friends. They changed characters over time, but they were always people that didn't know anything about modern-day life. Like, when I was really little, I spent a lot of time with, like, Laura Ingalls Wilder, who had never seen a television or anything, and I would explain how my television worked from what I could understand, and how running water worked, and what it's like to get on a school bus, and why things cost so much. Everything seemed so expensive to her. And when I was a little older, I learned about more remote places in the world, like Papua New Guinea. And I spent a lot of time with this boy from Papua New Guinea, and I explained everything going on in my life. And I explained, like, and that introduced a really cool element of, like, cultural relationships, like how friends interact or play or what kind of foods we eat. And that was a little bit more interesting than hanging out with Laura Ingalls Wilder. But
what did the boy from Papua New Guinea look like?
He was thin. He was probably about, like, 8, and he didn't wear a shirt. And he had short, like, cropped hair, brown, kind of brown skin, and nice boy. I don't remember seeing his face. I think he had big eyes, big brown eyes.
When did you stop hanging out with these people?
Well, this is the embarrassing part. I think it was, like, sixth grade when I was 11.
So was that 12, 11 or 12?
Yeah. I think what was satisfying was that someone took interest in all the little details of my life, and I was able to explain how, you know, oh, we get in the car, and this is how you open the handle, and, yeah, it's unlocking the door, and, yeah, this is metal, and, you know, things like that. It was really fun. It was really exciting to look at my life in a fresh way.
Huh. Well, that's a great way of expressing it. Marcia, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
I appreciate that. Do you hear that expressed that way in your research, Stephanie Carlson, that idea that, I mean, I like that, looking at my life in a fresh way?
Yeah. Well, I find that description really interesting because we've done some cultural research on the phenomenon, particularly with Old Order Mennonite children and adults in central Pennsylvania. And Old Order Mennonites are similar to the Amish. And we were interested in looking at pretend play in this subculture. In Mennonite society, some of the descriptions that we heard of their imaginary companions were people who lived a modern life that would be different from their own conscientious objection to any kind of modern living, such as cars and radios.
Hunter writes, as a child, I did and did not have an imaginary friend. I never really had one for myself, but my older sister had one, so I felt I was supposed to. So I made one up for the benefit of my parents and such. My sham imaginary friend's name was my imaginary friend named Joe, never just Joe. He stuck around for a few years, and then I finally got sick of the sham, so I decided to tell everyone that he'd moved to Antarctica to study penguins. A couple of email questions. What percentage of kids with imaginary friends are an only child? And sort of the flip side of that, another email, do identical twins have imaginary friends as often as the general population? Stephanie Carlson, how do you answer those?
Well, it is having an imaginary companion is more common in only children and firstborns, and so that there could be some time alone is a requirement, or makes it more likely that children will create one. And so the flip side of that might be that although we can't say systematically whether this is the case, that perhaps it is less common in identical twins or twins.
Carol's in Bothell. Hello, Carol.
Hi. The truth is I can't really remember my imaginary friend, but I do remember my mother telling me that whenever anything got broken or went missing, and she would ask me about it, I would refer her to my imaginary friend.
Please take it up with my imaginary friend and his lawyer, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is one of the more common descriptions that we get is the scapegoat imaginary companion.
Not me of Family Circus.
That's right, who has committed some misdeed. And in my research, when some parents have, Marjorie and I ask parents what they think about the imaginary companion, and one comment that we do get is, I don't really like it when they use the imaginary companion as a scapegoat. They can tolerate it or indulge in it to some extent, but then it starts to become a nuisance to the parent when it's a scapegoat.
And how do you suggest they respond to that, Marjorie Taylor, if that's the case?
Well, I don't think some parents are concerned, well, this is part of my child's imagination and I don't want to interfere, but I think any time that the child is trying to pull one over on you, you should probably be firm about that. And this is no different than any other case.
Carol, thanks a lot. Are you also looking at kids who don't have imaginary friends? And are you learning anything from that? Is there something different about kids who don't have imaginary friends than those who do?
Yeah, we look at a broad range of children, and we ask them about all different kinds of pretend play, and we ask their parents. And some children don't have imaginary friends. And one of the questions we were interested in was, how are these children, what are the characteristics of children who have imaginary friends? And what we found is actually that mostly they're very similar to other children. So it's not like children who have imaginary friends are very different on lots of dimensions. When we do find differences, they seem to be things like being better able to take the perspective of another person, for example, social understanding in preschool. These are things that are somewhat more elevated in children who have imaginary friends. But children who do not have imaginary friends, sometimes parents worry that their child doesn't have an imaginary friend. There are lots of different ways to develop creativity and imagination, and the imaginary friend is just one of those.
I see. Well, Marjorie Taylor, professor and head of psychology at the University of Oregon, author of Imaginary Companions and the Children Who Create Them, and Stephanie Carlson, assistant professor of the University of Washington in psychology and second author with Marjorie Taylor in a new study on imaginary friends that was published in the Developmental Psychology Journal. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you for your stories. Much appreciated. And say thank you to your imaginary friends as well. This is Weekday.